Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live. What? Every
that
Tuesday.
That is the second time I've done that to you. Sorry.
No problem. From Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are not joined with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. She is called in.
Oh, but we are.
Well, no, but not live. Not in the studio. She is called in to 718-497-2218. That's 718-497-2128. And you can, too, with all of your cooking-related questions. So, Nastasha, and Jack and Joe are here in the engineering booth, as always. Hey, gentlemen.
Hello.
So, Nastasha has lost all credibility with the cooking issues in the Heritage Radio team because we've heard her talk a big game about how much she hates the springtime weather. Hates the springtime weather, hates springtime people, hates people when they like the springtime weather. And where are you right now, Nastasha?
I'm at the beach, but I'm so happy that I'm not in New York because I don't have to see everybody in their flip-flops and the hipsters on their bikes and all that stuff.
You're at the beach seeing all that. What the hell's the difference?
No, there's no hipsters here. Zero hipsters.
Mm. So, yes. So she is in Rhode Island, and are you familiar with the actual full name of Rhode Island, Nastasha?
No.
Well, it is the...
What are you talking about?
Well, it's the smallest state in our union. However, it has the longest official name. It is the State of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. Were you aware of that?
Whoa, no, I wasn't.
Yeah, it's like it wasn't enough just to be the smallest. They also had to like tag the biggest name. And then they shafted Delaware. Delaware's like, almost. We're almost the smallest, but we got no sales tax. I think that's kind of what Delaware said, right? Because they couldn't change their name to like Delaware of Delaware and the Delaware Plantation because that would just be copying. Right?
Right, yes.
So, is it, I assume it's nice over there, although you know I would hate it.
Yeah, you would hate it. I'm not on it. I'm away from the sand, so.
Yes. For those out there, I like the idea of a beach. I love the beach in the wintertime, but the sun is my mortal enemy. Anyway. Okay, we got some questions in from Ryan Santos regarding Centrifuge. Hey, Dave and Nastasha, a customer who recently retired from medical equipment sales gifted us with an unused Centrifuge he had in his storage. It's small and runs fine, but is missing the containers for the inside. Though some research, the maximum this machine can take is 4x50 milliliter conical tubes. And as you're probably aware, those four small tubes and adapter are not cheap. $400 to $500 in total. Obviously, with the quantity limit, we won't be able to use, the amount they can spin it in at one time. We won't be able to use it for any real practical production use because 4x50 milliliters, as you guys can do in your head, maybe is 200 mils, which is a small amount. Is there any small specialty use that would warrant spending this kind of cash at that quantity? Will it hardly yield anything, even just for fun personal use? Well, $400 to $500 is a lot to spend on the tubes for a 200 mil machine. Now, if I didn't get a chance, it's a Thermo Scientific IEC Centra CL2. I didn't get a chance to look at the specific specs on that machine, but let's just say for the sake of argument that it can do 3,000 to 4,000 G's, and it has it doesn't have the like an R anywhere in it. Usually, refrigerated centrifuges have like a letter R in it somewhere, so it doesn't have a fridge. So you're going to be spending $500 to be doing 200 mils. Now, a 50 mil tube is a lot. For $250 or $200 or whatever, you can go on Amazon.com and buy one that does 100 mils at a time, half that, for like half the price. But those small tubes that it uses, the small one, what's the one that we use, Stas? What's the name of it again? You have one too. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. I'll have to look it up.
It's like Champion something, right? It's like Champion something. Anyway.
I'll look it up.
You know, that one's only a couple hundred bucks, and it's new, and you can almost, like, get rid of it when it's done. 200 mils is not going to be enough for large production runs. I would see if you can get it cheaper. If you actually have the metal tubes and you're just looking for the bottles, then, you know, you can get away with cheaper or not using it all. But I personally would be hesitant to invest $500 in something that can do 200 mils if you have the space to get a larger size one, because, you know, for $1,000 you can get a really good condition 3-liter unit, you know, like $1,000 to $1,200. So I would be hesitant. But on the other hand, if all you have is $500 and you want to get into centrifuges, it's the kind of thing where, you know, if you don't have a centrifuge yet and you want to take the plunge, then, you know, anything you can do to get you into the centrifuge business is going to eventually be good for you, because I've never had someone who's gotten a centrifuge. It's like, there's a couple things like that. It's like the VitaPrep. It's like an immersion circulator. No one's ever like, damn, I didn't use that. That sucked. You know what I mean? It doesn't happen. There are other pieces of equipment where I can see a little buyer's remorse when you're done with it. But if you're buying a centrifuge for commercial use in a restaurant or in a bar, it will pay for itself. So long as you use it right and you know, use it for menu items where it's going to save you big money on yield on your expensive items, it's going to make money back. So if it takes $400 to get you into the centrifuge thing so that you can then eventually go buy your 3-liter, then I think in the end you win. What do you think, Stas?
Yeah, I think that's good. And it is called the Champion E33 Benchtop Centrifuge on Amazon.
We got to get Buju Banton to rep that singing like a champion, walk like a champion for that centrifuge. You think we could put those two guys together? They're down in Georgia or Florida somewhere. And I think when he's in the U.S., he's down
I
there.
I thought he's in jail.
But I'm saying I think that's where he got arrested, down there. So maybe they can arrange something.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone know? Is Buju Banton still in jail? Were those cocaine charges trumped up? Does anyone know? Does anyone even know who I'm talking about?
I'm going to Google it.
All right, very good. Okay, so there you have it. Now, by the way, for those of you out there, we decided for the torch to go with the name Sears All because, Nastasha, does it sear some things?
No.
Most things?
No.
So if you have anything, choose anything. If you have that, will it sear that?
Yes.
So it's pretty much a Sears All?
Yes.
Sears All. Yeah. All right.
That's the name.
Yeah, not Sears Some. That would be a terrible name. Sears Some would be like the worst name in the world. But Sears All, that's a strong name. However, Nastasha still has a soft spot for all searing eyes. So she says that under her breath all the time.
Yes.
She just walks around mumbling it. She, you know, in 30 years, she's gonna be that lady wandering around the Lower East Side mumbling, or Hell's Kitchen mumbling, "Oh, Siri, oh, Siri, oh, Siri." That's gonna be her. And I still refer to it as the Sally Sears All because I like the word Sally. But you know, there you have it. So that's the name. We shot some video, so look for some video up on the blog soon showing techniques on how to use it and kind of what it's good for. Now, Ken Ingber, longtime listener, supporter of MOFAD. I don't know if he's a supporter of the radio network or not. I don't know. But a supporter of the Museum of Food and Drink and a longtime listener, writes in and is excited about the Sears All but has these questions. One, what does this product do that an inexpensive, widely available, and time-tested electric paint stripper will not do? If a lower temperature is key, is it possible that a home cook might be better off with a lower temp on a paint gun? I have used the paint gun, and I think there's a couple things I don't like about it. One, they're actually not cheap. Like, paint stripping guns are like, you know, you'd think that they're like $20. They're not. They're like $80 or more. And so they're actually, they're more than what we hope to sell this unit for. We don't know what we're going to sell it for because a lot depends on how much it costs for insurance and shipping and boxing and all that other stuff. But we're hoping to have it be price competitive with those guns. Secondly, those suckers require a cord, which I detest having a cord running around. They don't heat up as quickly as you'd like, and it's kind of hard to judge. I've used them before. They just don't do the same thing. It's just not the same thing. They're just not the same, having used those things. Now, I like those hot air guns for other things, for heat shrink tubing, man. Those things cannot be beat. I used to have one. Someone stole it. Have you ever noticed that happens with me? I'm like, I lend something to people, Stas, and then they just steal it from me?
Yeah.
Equipment, techniques, I'm just kidding.
The latter makes me the most angry.
I'm just kidding. I'm just messing around with you.
You're not kidding.
Well, whole in jest, half in earnest there. Anyway, okay. Two, this is Ken asking more questions. Would I get the same effect if I held an $8 replacement camping light gas mantle with tongs in front of a torch? I mean, leave aside the bonus thorium on my chicken skin. Well, for those of you that don't know, it's a fiber that they weave into cloth. This is how they make those really bright gas lanterns for camping. They take a cloth, they put some like a very high temp refractory fiber in it, and they dope it with thorium, which is a substance. And then when they light fire to it, the fabric burns away, and the mantle becomes exceedingly fragile. And then the whole sucker incandesces like a weasel when you light it on fire. And that's how those mantle based gas lamps work. Now, trick with that is, besides the awesome thorium, as you point out, mantle's quite small and exceedingly fragile, and also excuse me, wouldn't work the same way. I bike today, which is why you hear the incredible hacking and coughing every once in a while, and I inhale some more of that cement. You know that cement place does?
Yes.
It's like make it all the way here and you're fine, and then like a block from Roberta's, you inhale like a lung full of cement dust, and then you're hacking and wheezing for the rest of the day. Anyway, I don't think it would work for that reason. Secondly, when you have tongs and you're shooting at something, you tend to lose a lot of heat to backspray, which is why we have the cone. The real trick of the whole device here is an incredibly low thermal mass, such that the sucker heats up very, very quickly. But doing that with a material that maintains its structural integrity and strength at the elevated temperatures that we're talking about, and they're quite hot. The outer screen probably only gets up to like, 1,300 Fahrenheit or something like that. But the inner screen probably gets up closer to like 1,700 Fahrenheit or something like in that range. So it's right at the upper level of even what the metals we're using can do. And in fact, we're still playing with the alloys there. So those mantles, extremely fragile. This thing needs to be more kind of bulletproof for kitchen use. Yes, Daz?
Yep.
Yep. Number three, are you doing anything about stability? A hardware store propane canister is comfortable to hold and has a large capacity, but is inherently unstable. Don't I know it? Which is why we have a patent pending on a clamp that not only holds the propane canister when you're using the Searzol, but also holds it when you're using a regular torch, which I think is inherently dangerous in any effect, in any way. Anyway, okay. Hardware store propane canister is comfortable to hold, large capacity, but inherently unstable with a small base and a high center of gravity. The heat of the usual Bernzomatic nozzle is dangerous, but I suspect that the ignition level temperature dissipates pretty quickly. Adding this salamander, the Searzol, to the top makes the total package tippier and perhaps retains a dangerous temperature level. That is a serious risk in a busy commercial kitchen and a nightmare for consumer use. Well, I'll just finish the whole thing and then I'll go into it. But, I mean, this is like one of the main things that we're addressing. So, I mean, it's good that someone asked and I can talk about it here. Okay. So as to the last point on the danger, I'm of two minds when it comes to Dave's tinkering. The Heathkit customer, me, by the way, for those of you that, you know, I don't know if we have young listeners out there, Heathkit was a company back in the day that became well known after World War II for supplying parts. You could build things like, or kits. You could buy things like oscilloscopes. When I was a kid, they sold a robot. They have like, you know, anyway. So like amateur electronics, like what, you know, what all the Arduino kids are doing now, like used to be Heathkit, but you know, anyway, whatever. Okay, the Heathkit customer me is amused by what Dave by Dave's hacking of, say, an electric pressure cooker. What could go wrong, in joking parens? But the lawyer in me is more than a little apprehensive, especially when he posts instructions on the back on the pressure cooker. Although, to be fair to me, I said do not do it. Remember that, Stas?
Yeah, that was the first sentence you wrote in that story.
I was like, do not do this. Do not do this. By the way, that pressure cooker still runs well. I've not had a problem with it. So, again, don't modify your pressure cooker to get to the actual 15 PSI that God wants it to be at, even though I highly recommend only cooking with 15 PSI pressure cookers, and it's theoretically possible to take the Cuisinart electric pressure cooker and make it do 15 PSI. I have to urge you to not actually modify it according to the instructions I post on the blog. Right, Stas?
Right.
Hey, Dave.
Yes.
I have two things. So, Buju Banton is in jail until 2019. And also, you have a caller.
Oh. All right. Well, let me just finish this question, and then I'll take the caller, and then I'll answer the question.
Okay, great.
Poor Buju. What was it? Was it cocaine?
Yeah, it was cocaine.
Yeah. In Florida?
I believe so.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Okay, but the lawyer in me is more than a little apprehensive, especially when he posts instructions. The Sears oil will probably be considered a consumer product, and the manufacturer and seller assume some serious liability, or at least the likelihood of consumer injury lawsuits win or lose. Good luck, and I expect to invest, but just in time, as BAM's Nomiku immersion circulator seems to have overcome some design and manufacturing issues and is on the verge of production now, delayed from last December. As I write Verge, listen carefully, and you will hear the derisive laughter I get from my wife and friends. Wow, is that a slap down on Wepop?
That is a Wepop
on the Wepop. Hey, you know I'm a big fan of the Wepop. Wepop's chilling in where is he, in Thailand now? Anyway, so I'll get back. I'll answer that question on safety and the Sears all after this caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, Dave. Two or three unrelated questions here.
Cool.
First one on pickling. The reference. Everything I read about it. I got to change room too. You're not going to be able to hear me over the kid. Everything I read on pickling says that if you hit 4.9 on the pH, that that's sort of an intrinsically safe pickle.
Okay, you mean regardless of salt content or anything?
Well, that's, or at least, you can. If you get to 4.9, you can go with a reasonable salt content.
Right, okay.
I mean, clearly, if you put enough salt in it, anything's safe.
Oh, yeah.
Does anybody make a test strip for that?
Oh, for that explicit number?
Yes.
Jeez, you know that's a good question. You'd think that they would. But the thing is with the test strips, pH meters are really not that they're not that expensive anymore. I think you can get one now. Like I think you know are you familiar with X-Tech?
I'm very familiar with Fluke. X-Tech is sort of the lower line company.
Exactly.
You're telling me that Fluke's pH meter or somebody's like that is no longer the price of a decent used car?
No. Fluke is. I mean, like that's the thing. Like, so you're gonna pay for quality. You know what I mean? So if you're gonna use it, if you were gonna use something like now, I know more about multimeters than I know about pH test. You know, pH testers, right?
But yes.
If I'm an engineer and I'm going to go out in the job site and I know things are going to get dropped and my buddy who doesn't know how to do anything from a hot rock is going to take it and is going to stick the probes on something weird, I'm going to go with the Fluke, right? Now, if I'm just at home, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, Fluke is a well-known and trusted brand of test equipment. And they have a characteristic look and you know a Fluke when you look at it across the room, right? Okay, so we're on the same page. Now, I used to be the kind of guy that would only ever buy quality equipment because I knew that if I didn't buy quality equipment, it was going to come back to bite me somehow. That at some point I would assume that I owned something that worked and I would need it right then and it wouldn't work and I'd be let down and it would be worse than having nothing at all. That's just my general experience. However, as I age, I realize that sometimes it's okay if you have one application, you know it'll work for it, and you know you can be ginger with it, you're not going to take it out on a job site, and it gets relatively good reviews, then you can go ahead and get the cheaper one. And so with something like a pH meter, I think you could probably get away with something from X-Tech at like less than half of what you would pay for, you know, the brand you trust. I don't know whether you can go that same route or not, or like whether it's not in you to buy a piece of equipment that you don't trust.
At any rate, X-Tech is generally adequate for the once a month I'm going to do this.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, I've owned a couple of their products, and I'm trying to remember if I ever had a problem with one or whether I've ever heard that they were unresponsive if the stuff breaks. The problem with pH meters in general, if you've never had one, is that you need to keep – what goes wrong with them is that the – especially the inexpensive ones you use. I don't have the glass tip ones, which is, you know, the kind that like a lot of people have. I have the ones with the little metal thing and shield at the bottom. It actually does a couple different things. It also do TDS a couple other measurements on it. You have to keep the cap wet at all times. If the probe dries out, the probe's shot, and then you have to buy another replacement tip for it. So that's the one caveat. You need to buy the probe and you need to buy the buffer solutions, and if you calibrate it right, it's a good investment, and you just gotta make sure that there's a little sponge inside the cap, and you gotta make sure that sponge stays wet so that the probe doesn't dry out and get ruined. And I don't know of any reasonably priced one where that's not the case, but I've had one for several years and it's still working for me. So I wouldn't do it if I was doing it professionally, but it's served me okay.
All right, and then the specific thing that led me to this question, I make this Vietnamese hot sauce, basically. It's one-third fish sauce, one-third lime juice, one-third sugar, and then I just mandolin some form of hot pepper in there until there's no more room left.
Right.
And if you leave it in the fridge for a week or two, it seems to pickle beautifully. Other than buying a pH meter, is there any way to, like, be relatively sure that's not going to kill somebody?
Yeah, so it's like one-third lime, you said, and one-third
lime, one-third sugar, one-third fish sauce. The fish sauce is 1,500 milligrams of sodium per tablespoon.
Yeah, well, you know the fish sauce isn't going to go anywhere. Lime juice is not going to support too much growth. Sugar is going to be reducing the water activity. So the real question is what's the weight ratio of the product to the pickle? Now, you know, I don't know whether the salt level there is sufficient to inhibit anything but lactic acid. Does it get a lactic taste after a while? Are you getting some actual fermentation?
Yes. And like you can see the peppers, you know, the peppers go from bright green. It's like they absorb the fish sauce and just get a very subtle different flavor to them.
Right, but then it does actually ferment out and you get lactic acid bacteria in there?
I think so.
And you're probably fine. I mean, like, okay. you're just jumpstart. You know, by lowering the pH initially, you're then selecting for more for lactic acid bacteria to grow rather than other nasty stuff. So, you know, I think you're, I mean, again, like, I would get the pH meter and test it, but I wouldn't feel too nervous about it. I'm not gonna come out and say that's a safe thing because I haven't run the numbers or looked at the system or gone and checked any data on the web. But, I mean, I would feel comfortable serving it to my family, let's put it that way.
Okay, so fair enough.
Yeah.
Completely separate question. You were talking the other day about pizza steels.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, I've never used one. Now, Chris Young was talking to me about it, and they have someone in Massachusetts making it.
I'm really interested in buying one, but if I do, I'd like to use it for a few things besides pizza.
Sure.
Is it thick enough not to warp if it's heated unevenly, or is it...
You want to use it on the range?
This question, but like I can get my grill up to ridiculous temperatures.
Right.
If I turn the rotisserie burner on too, so the rotisserie burner is radiating down from above at the same time the grill is going full up from below, and I mean it gets hot in there, like 700 and something degrees hot.
Right.
I'm afraid to do it to a ceramic pizza stone that way because I know the dang thing will crack.
Oh, you've tried it?
No, but I mean, just ceramic, they're typically not like to be heated unevenly.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's true.
It's a $50 experiment I've refrained from doing.
Right.
So, I mean, now clearly the steel's not going to crack. Do you have any feel for how likely it would be to take a permanent warp?
I haven't thought about it. However, I'll say this. You're going to buy it from the guy in Massachusetts that's making it with the Modernist Cuisine label on it?
Yes, that is my intention. Cost about $75.
Okay, so I don't remember exactly how thick it is, but remember the whole Megillah on that sucker is that it's thick enough to store up enough thermal energy to put a wallop into your crust, right?
Right.
So you're going to have some inherent stiffness from just the fact that it's a thicker material, but the other good news is you're not heating it up to like a cherry red. You're not like putting an oxyacetylene flame on it and melting it out. It's probably going to take quite a bit of energy to warp that out, as opposed to like, you know, a black steel pan, which is incredibly easy to warp on a range, right?
Yeah, been there, done that.
Yeah, and you're probably going to have a more widespread out heat pattern than you would on a range if you're doing it on a grill. But the good news is this. I don't know that guy in Massachusetts. I've never met him, never spoken to him. However, I have spoken to Chris Young about him when they were starting that project, because he was here on the radio show like a year or so ago talking about it. And the fellow that's doing it is an engineer. And I'm biased because I got a family full of engineers, but my feeling is that it's probably something that he's tested, because engineers are like that. You know what I mean?
So it's worth calling them and asking them the question.
I would call him personally and ask a question. My impression is he's not like some giant conglomerate. He's a human being. But, I mean, he has a real company that does other stuff, like a bigger company. I believe he's a metal fabricator or something like that, or has some sort of large shop. But the guy who spearheaded that at that company, he might be the owner or not, is an actual human being.
I will attempt to look him up. And then third, again, completely unrelated question. I use my sous vide setup more for confit than anything else.
Sure.
And it works fantastic, and I love it. But basic food safety question, if it's been in 180 degree, you know, a reasonable size bag, been in 180 degrees Fahrenheit for, you know, 8-10 hours, is it essentially, I mean, canned? I mean,
no.
Do I need to worry about the big ice water bath? And
yeah, no, it is not. It is not canned. And yes and no. Here's the deal. So, the original old school confit recipes, right, have a fairly extensive salting regimen prior to the confit process. They also have, you know, a classic bunch of herbs that gets packed into it. Those herbs, thyme and whatnot, are, you know, are bacteriostatic, have some bacteriostatic effect. And salt is there to provide to provide, you know, some bacterial protection. So now I don't know of any cases of someone getting, what you're worried about is spore forming bacteria here. You're going to kill all the vegetative stuff, but you're not going to wipe out the spores. So the question is the water, and here's the other problem. When you're doing a traditional confit, you have first the salt that gets rid of some moisture and increases the salt level. That's inhibiting bacteria. You have the putting of the herbs on. That's somewhat inhibiting bacteria, although it's hard to quantify. You then have the traditional confit in an open roaster, let's say, or on a pot and a stove. And that sucker is also getting rid of moisture because moisture is evaporating off and can get out. When you're doing it in the bag, most modern confit recipes don't have as much salt, so I can't guarantee that it's bacteriostatic. You're not necessarily using the same herb profile, so can't guarantee bacteriostatic there. And also, you're not evaporating the moisture out of the bag. The moisture stays in the bag, which is why you get a little gelée in the bottom of a bag confit item. Now, I like all that in terms of taste, but I wouldn't trust it for room temperature and for not having spores in it. Okay, so I would, you know, if you want to do it that way, you know, you got to get a retort bag. You can buy retort bags, and then just, you know, you could pressure the retort bag, and then those suckers are sterile. They'd be shelf stable at that point.
Okay, so all right, so I need to be more cautious on this than on the pickle question.
I would, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. That was my question.
All right, thank you
very much.
Thank you. Have a good one.
You too.
All right, Jack, let's go to our first commercial break. I'll come back with some safety issues on the Sears All Cooking Issues.
Program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surifarms.com. Did you know HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization? If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
Nice. Glad to see Sam Edwards is supporting the show. You know I like the S. Wallace Edwards ham. Joe, you like that stuff?
I do enjoy the Suriano ham. And Dave, you have another caller.
I do?
Yep.
Suriano, S. Wallace Edwards, great product. I don't like the name. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. It's Aaron Warren calling from Edmonton, Alberta. I just had a question for you about soda streams.
About what?
About SodaStream.
Oh, cool. All right.
Okay, so I purchased just a cheapo used SodaStream online, and I did some research previous to it and noticed that there's a company that basically is able to provide you with a clip so that you can put a CO2 cartridge onto the SodaStream without purchasing it or exchanging it directly through them. But upon further reading, I noticed that the CO2 actually isn't food grade. It's paintball CO2, or designed for paintball guns. Is that a concern?
Well, that's an interesting question. So, you know, if you go to the big restaurant shows, there are companies that only supply CO2 for the beverage industry, right? And also, if you buy your gases from people like ISI, let's say, in the small cartridges, you know, they make a lot about the purity of the gases that go in it. I have always, and everyone I know, purchases CO2 not from paintball suppliers, but from welding suppliers, including, it, you know, restaurants and, you know, most of those. Unless you're getting your gas directly from Coca-Cola or Pepsi or whoever you deal with, you know, Universal Beverage or Coke, whoever you deal with, you know, pretty much we're all using the welding gas, and that's it. I've never noticed any taste problems or anything like that. I mean, the stuff is, you know, it's high purity. I don't know. I can't say as I've studied it too much, except for I don't ever worry about it. And I've actually filled. I have a 40 pound or 50 pound siphon tank, and I fill up smaller things, including 20-ounce paintball tanks, with it. Fill it myself, you know. Although I don't recommend filling your own tanks unless you do like a lot of reading on the safety, because if you fill your own tank and you do it wrong, you cause a serious. It's a serious hazard. An incorrectly filled tank is a serious hazard. So I don't, you know, I don't recommend doing it unless you've done a lot of research on it. But yes, I wouldn't worry about it. I think, you know. The SodaStream people have done a great service to the world in that they've brought home carbonated beverages to a large, large number of people, but they are ripping you off for CO2. There is another...
Oh, exactly, and that's kind of why I wanted to go with this little mod clip that they have, is just so I could basically cheap out a bit more on that without spending the $200 or $300 it would cost me to get the, you know, 20-pound tank and the regulator.
That's
and all
the thing, 20-pound tank, a 20-pound tank... And a regulator is not that expensive. Everyone buys it, and this is no offense to any homebrew people that are listening, but those guys are small shops. They need to make they make their profit off, but they don't sell that many, right? So the prices on like a tank are fairly high in a regulator. You know, if you can get a 5-pound tank, which is a lot easier to sling if you're going if you're doing it in your house in a 20. And I want to say that a 5-pound tank. Is it's way under $100, and a regulator is like 30 if you get it from Mark Powers in the Guntersville, Alabama. I don't know about Canada. I don't know what the rules are up there. You know, I hesitate buying a used tank just because you got to make sure when you buy a used. I mean, you can. I have, but you got to make sure when you buy a used tank that it's still certified. Otherwise, you're going to have to get it certified. You know what I mean? But once you get the investment in once you have that tank, then. The CO2 is so cheap, it's ridiculous. Your price per liter drops to, you know, like a penny. It's ridiculous. You know, like a 20-pound CO2 tank does, like, on the order of 200 gallons of seltzer water. I mean, think about that. And let's say it's $20, which I don't even think it's $20. So that's $20 for 200 gallons. You can really get more. That's, what is that? That's $10. That's a dollar for 10 gallons. Is that right? Is that right?
Yeah.
It's a dollar for 10 gallons. So that's 10 cents a gallon. That's like 2.5 cents a liter. Think about that.
Yeah. Ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, you're not going to run out very often. So
No, never. Not, you know, once every couple of years, probably.
Yeah. I mean, look, once you have it in your house, I go through a lot of stuff. I go through tanks and tanks and tanks, especially, you know, when you first set up your rig, you'll probably have a leaky system and you'll lose your tank a lot faster than you should. But yeah. Tank lasts a good long time, even with a family of four that drinks almost exclusively seltzer. It lasts a good long time. So I would definitely go that route. It's going to save you money in the long run, for sure. And then later on, if you decide to move on to a different system, you already have the tank. You can do anything you want. If you want to get a carbonator cap system and take a T-branch off your regulator and then do cocktails that way, which is kind of more flexible than doing it SodaStream style, you can. That's only another $15, $16 investment to your system because you can upgrade it right away and you're not paying for a preposterous amount for the CO2 every time you do it. Everyone tries to make their money on the gas. And for me, that's just not a proposition I enjoy.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
All right, great. Thanks for all the info, Dave. Appreciate it. Love the show.
Oh, thanks a lot. No problem. Good luck with it. Okay, so back to the safety on Ken Ingber's question on the Searsol. So the... first of all, obviously, we have lawyers looking at it. We have insurance companies we're talking to about getting insurance, and like I'm sure a good chunk of the cost of the item to the consumer is going to be our insurance for it. But we're doing a lot of work to make sure that the product itself is safe. So the initial design of it was kind of operator ease of use and comfort, right? So the cone was there originally to stop heat from coming back on your knuckles, to make sure that everything worked fine there. Then after we got initial usability down, we focused, a lot of our attention is being focused right now on safety issues. So, the very first thing we said is this thing is too tippy. So we made a clamp that fits on it. And the clamp actually is kind of cool because the clamp will fit on a butane tank, the tall propane tank, and the camping propane tank. It'll also fit on a wine bottle if you want to take it to a picnic. So your wine, So your wine bottle doesn't fall over. That's the only thing Nastasha cares about, is that it fits on the wine bottle. Right, Stas?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the name of this thing, Dave?
It's the Jed Clamp. Because why?
We're stupid.
Yeah, we're stupid. But what? But no one. But some people might not get it. Go get the Jed Clamp. Jed Clamp it. Jed Clamp it. Get it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a good one, right? And everyone's like, "You're stupid. That's a dumb name." And you're like, "Guess what? I don't care. I get to name it. You don't. It's the Jed Clamp." Anyway, so Jed Clamp will fit on a propane tank, butane tank, wine bottle, you name it. In fact, eventually, we want to sell that sucker just for use with regular torches, because I've always thought torches were unsafe standing up there on its own. So that's something we addressed. But Dave Chang especially was like, people aren't always going to put the clamp on. So we're trying to engineer it such that it's safe even without that. First of all, the one that has been on our web there is, if we've modified it since then, there's a safety cage around it. And the safety cage is made of wire so that it doesn't retain heat very much. And you can literally knock it over on the table and it won't catch anything on fire. And it's still hot, not going to lie, but you can hit it after it's been on for a long time and not sustain horrible burns as if like you would if the naked cone fell on you. And we're still right now, one of the reasons we haven't kickstarted yet is we're still working on a bunch of different safety tweaks to make it as safe as we possibly can. And in addition, of course, it's going to come with a list of instructions a mile long on what to do and what not to do. But rest assured that the safety of the product is, once we came up with the functionality that we liked, the safety of the product is our primary concern. Wouldn't you say that's true, Stas?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That was good. That's enough on that, right, Stas?
Bueno?
Okay, bueno. Brandon Hodkins writes in from Phoenix, Arizona. I haven't been to Phoenix in a long time. Stas, you ever been to Phoenix?
Yes, I have. I don't like it.
What? What do you have against Phoenix?
What? You don't like it?
What is it?
There's
no hipsters
Arizona
there, Stas.
People are weird.
What? Who the hell do you like? You don't like hipsters?
Yeah, I have a new contest. You'll get a free T-shirt if you write in 5 things Nastasia likes.
Yeah.
No one will ever win that.
Do it.
No one will ever win that.
Yeah.
Now, like, you'd have that contest done before the end of the show if you're like, tweet in 5 things she hates.
Yeah.
It'd be over.
Yeah, that's not the point.
Yeah, 5 things she likes. So what do you have against Phoenix besides the awesome saguaro cactuses and the awesome smell of the desert?
My grandmother lived there. I do like Sedona. Sedona is beautiful. Have you been there?
Whoa, you like Sedona? You don't, wait, hold up. You don't like hipsters, but you like weird hippie freaks? No offense, Sedona?
No, I like the landscape. I don't like the weird hippie freak part.
No offense, weird hippie freaks. We love you. But yeah, no, Sedona's nice. My my father-in-law used to fly into Sedona's airport, and that's a bumpy ride in a Cessna 172, let me tell you. Anyway, I like Phoenix. I think it's good stuff. I haven't been out there in a long, long, long time, probably 13 years. Anyway, I hope they got the pollution problem fixed. You know, when I used to go out there in the 90s, they were like the last place on Earth you could still use leaded gas. I hope they've changed that. I have no idea. Anyway, Brandon says, I discovered your podcast a few weeks ago and have been catching up on episodes since then. I have a few questions. I bought a PolyScience Creative Series circulator last week and have been using Ziploc bags per your low-temperature primer. Are there any applications where a vacuum sealer is a must-have? For example, would I need to vacuum seal short ribs before I cook them for 72 hours? No, you don't. Well, we'll get into it. Would the VacMaster VP112 chamber sealer work well enough to also do a quick pickling, or would I need a more expensive chamber sealer for that? So let's handle this before we before I get on to the second question. So here's the deal. You can do, and I say this in the you know, when we used to teach it, you know, you can do 90% of what you want to do without a vacuum by using Ziplocs. However, right, if you seal something in a vacuum bag, so that's just from a cooking standpoint. Vacuum shines in food preservation, right? So there's two reasons to use there's many, but you know, two of the main reasons to use a vacuum machine are: one, you can bag things so you can do low temperature cooking, and for me personally, that's the most important thing. Two, by removing the oxygen from the bag, you are, and also by removing any sort of gas content, if you're going to freeze, let's say, something, if you're going to freeze it, by removing air and or oxygen, all that stuff, you are preserving the product in a better condition for a longer time. Also doing things like preventing freezer burn if you're going to freeze, et cetera, preventing crystallization because there's no surface from which the water can migrate out and form crystals on the surface. Okay? So for preservation, you need a vacuum, and the better the vacuum, the happier you're going to be. I have the VacMaster VP112, which is what you're talking about, is I've never used it, but I've looked at it on the web a bunch of times. It is a lot cheaper than the pumps, the vacuum sealers that I'm used to. And what it amounts, it's a chamber machine, which means that you're not sucking the air out of the bag. You're sucking the air out of a chamber and then sealing the bag. That, by far and away, is the better system to use than one where you're sucking air out of the bag. I've had nothing but bad luck with the ones where you suck the air out of the bag, with the exception of like 36-inch striped bass, which I can't figure out how to seal any other way. So the chamber is a good way to go, but the VacMaster looks like just kind of like a food saver on steroids. And by that I mean it doesn't have a commercial quality vacuum pump in it. All of the big kid vacuum machines, the chamber machines, have in them a Bush pump made by the Bush Corporation. And those things are monsters. They're always work. They're awesome, right? They suck a very fast vacuum, and go down to a very low number of millibars. So they're just a good piece of equipment all the way around. And all of the major ones that you find, you know, Minipack, Multivac, and Koch, they all use that brand because everyone knows they're the best ones out there for normal use, right? Now, this guy has a piston pump in it, which it has its limitations. It's never going to pump as hard a vacuum as those other things. It's never going to pump as quickly as those other things. Now, the question is it enough? I don't know. You know, when I looked on the web, I looked this morning and I looked at a bunch of reviews online of people that have it. You know, they buy it at Cabela's, which is, the sporting goods store, because, you know, hunters buy it and things like this. And some of the people that have it like it. However, I never saw this. I never saw, hey, you know what? I'm used to working in a kitchen or in a processing plant with, a real vacuum machine, like a mini pack. And I had this one and it's almost as good. Didn't see that once. I did not see one consumer or one customer review of that machine that said that it compared to what I would consider to be, you know, the commercial machines that I'm used to. And I will also say I spoke to a mini pack rep yesterday, and he said that in one of the places they sell a lot of vacuum things in Alaska because they have a lot of fish and they're vacuuming the fish down, you know, for freezing and shipping. And he says that literally in their showroom, they have that unit, the vac master, sitting next to their unit, so you can make a decision for yourself which way to go. Now, at home, maybe it's enough. I don't really know how high of a vacuum level it can get. If the vacuum pump is no better than a food saver, it's not going to do as good a job at Quick Pickles, anywhere near as good a job as a real vacuum machine can do, but I don't have any personal experience with it. What do you think, Stas?
Good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be snobby about it. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I'm being a jerk because it is literally a third of the price of the next machine up. One third. You know what I mean? So I don't know whether you can get away with it or not. No one's ever sent us one, so I can't make an informed judgment. If anyone out there in Twitter land has used both like a regular commercial machine, like a mini pack, a multivac, or a Koch, or something similar, and one of those vac masters, please just tweet in and tell us what you think, whether or not it was whether or not it would do anything. Okay, second question: is there a way to make powdered Dr. Pepper? That's all you, Stas.
Yeah, wouldn't you put it in liquid nitrogen?
No, that would just freeze it. That would just freeze it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, second question. Is there a way to make powdered Dr. Pepper? I thought it would make a good addition to spice rubs. If it is possible, what would be the shelf life? Well, the shelf life would probably be non-finite. You know what I mean? If you could do it. Here's the problem. Dehydrating things with sugar in them can be quite difficult because the more you dehydrate something, kind of the more the sugar doesn't want to lose that last little bit of water until you crystallize it out. But it's more difficult to crystallize because they're using high fructose corn syrup, et cetera, et cetera. Here's what you do. First of all, forget using regular Dr. Pepper, right? Forget it. Just go to – I saw it on the Sam's Club website this morning. You can buy Dr. Pepper syrup. I couldn't locate the exact bricks, but since Dr. Pepper is probably somewhere around 11 bricks, and since it's a 5-to-1 syrup to soda ratio, that means that you multiply by 6 to get the bricks. So it's probably somewhere in the area of 60 to 66 bricks, meaning 66% sugar in the syrup that you get. So for every kilo of that, you only need to remove 333 mils of water. Now, what I would do is you could try boiling some water out, but it's going to get sludgy. It's going to heat up fast. Once it heats up, it's going to start changing the flavor. You could try spreading it thin and putting it in a dehydrator and then trying to get it down to something more brittle and then pulverizing it with the rest of your salt rub so that your salt or your spice rub absorbs some of the extra moisture and it's going to turn grainy and sandy. You could do that. But, you know, short of that, you're going to need like something commercial, like a spray dryer, or what I would more preferably do is freeze dry. Because freeze dried, you could get it down to a powder. It would just be like sugar and it wouldn't have any heat damage. But I don't know anyone that makes it freeze dried. And actually, Stas, did you ever find that person who could do contract freeze drying?
Yeah, I have a guy.
Yeah?
In Massachusetts, yeah.
Tweet it out. Tweet it out. Nastasha on what's your Twitter there? HammerBDX?
HammerBDX, yeah.
Yeah, Nastasha will Twitter out the person who can do contract freeze drying because maybe they can freeze dry you some Dr. Pepper syrup and then you have Dr. Pepper powder. They made a Dr. Pepper gum. When I say – I forget who made it, but I saw that on the web too. They made it. Here's an interesting thing about Dr. Pepper. I looked it up. Of course I looked it up. So the flavorings – did you know Stas does not contain prune juice?
What?
Dr. Pepper? Years I always thought it was prune. In fact, there's no prune in it or prune flavor. And like everyone.
Hey, you know what?
What?
You just mentioned one thing that I like, so that's a free giveaway for someone today.
So is that still count though? Oh, yeah, all right. Fair. So, but still, like naming four things, we're going to be waiting for Godot with this thing. So Dr. Pepper doesn't actually contain prunes. But that kind of spoils it for me because, like, I love the whole prune thing. In fact, my favorite – you know how, like, every soda has, like, a ripoff brand at the supermarket?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, whatever. And my favorite Dr. Pepper ripoff is a Dr. Thunder, presumably because of the effect of the prune on your GI tract. Dr. Thunder. Anyway, so point is – doesn't contain prune. Here, according to – there's a FAQ, an FAQ, and here you look it up under freenewyork.net, DP FAQ, standing for Dr. Pepper FAQ. And here's what they list. They go through a bunch of things. This seems kind of relatively true. Vanilla, almond, right? And this is why it's amaretto and rum is the flaming Dr. Pepper shot. So because it's vanilla, almond, denatured rum, which they probably means like some sort of rum, de-alcoholized rum, oil of orange, and phosphoric acid and lactic acid, and also some citric. So a really interesting acid blend in there. And so those flavors explain why the flaming Dr. Pepper, which is amaretto and rum lit on fire, why that tastes like a Dr. Pepper is because you've hit, if you put a little orange in it, you've hit pretty much all the high notes in, especially if you use an aged rum, which is going to have the vanilla notes from the wood. You've hit almost all the high notes in a Dr. Pepper. That's cool, right, Stas?
Yeah. Really cool.
Are you a fan of the flaming Dr. Pepper drink?
Not really.
You prefer the actual Dr. Pepper?
I do. Okay. I do. You know it. Every lunch, every Tuesday.
Yes, that's true. So, like, I'm not going to even eat lunch because, like, what am I going to? By the way, so the reason why Nastasha and I do this show is not for you fine listeners out there, although I guess it is
for the pizza.
It's for the pizza and the salad. We get a pizza and a salad. That's the
wow,
pay.
Wow, really? That's it?
That's the big bucks we make, and getting to talk to Jack and Joe every week,
yeah.
Which is like getting two pizzas and a salad, really.
Basically,
no. And being Indie Jesus sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. Although he hates us because you know you talk smack about him.
Jack and I equal one pizza.
I thought that was good. You want it? I mean, like, you think
that's fine. That's about it. That's accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so like, I'm not that guy that's going to sit here and just eat my pizza by myself in silence. I'm not going to have lunch this week. Unless you guys want to eat with me. Do you guys want to eat with me?
I don't know. Maybe Joe can have a pizza with you and, yeah.
All right. Nice. All right, Stas. Stas, you've been replaced. Kidding.
No.
All right. So, Chris Anderson from Modernist Pantry writes in.
Hey, Chris.
Modernist Pantry. Hope all is well. We have just been getting a number of calls lately from your listeners looking for Novo Shape. I just wanted to let you know we are now stocking it based on your recommendation. Chris Anderson from Modernist Pantry. Novo Shape. Good call. Stas, let's order some of that stuff for ourselves because I don't think I have any left. Here's the deal with Novo Shape. Novo Shape, it's the exact opposite of the enzyme that we use almost all the time, which is Pectinex Ultra SPL. Novo Shape cross-links in the presence of calcium. Don't forget to add your calcium, people. You need to add calcium, and it cross-links pectins in the presence of it and makes fruit and other vegetables a lot firmer. So like the ossified vegetables or whatever that they, you know, do at Mugaritz or that they do at Noma, all that, you can do that without using very heavily flavor-mediated calciums by using Novo Shape in conjunction with like a milder calcium. Also, if you want to make yourself some cocktail cherries from fresh cherries when cherry season runs around, or when any of your fresh fruits are coming in and you want to can them and have a real nice firm fruit, you can use Novo Shape and calcium and really firm the fruit up so that it keeps for a long time if you're going to brandy it or something like that. So as the spring and summer rolls around and the fruit comes in, consider getting some Novo Shape to really just increase the quality of your brandied and candied fruits. How's that for a pitch? Yeah. Okay. Finally, Eric writes in on the red velvet cake. Hey, cooking, and I know we've dealt a little bit with red velvet cake in the past, but here we go. Hey, Cooking Issues crew, I've been looking into red velvet cakes recently, and I'd love to find a recipe without dye or beets. My research showed that the anthocyanins would turn the batter red. The anthocyanins, you turn the batter red with buttermilk and vinegar. The problem is most cocoa in these recipes is Dutch processed and is thus too basic. I'm not looking for an extreme blood red, but something more than the brown chocolate cake that normally comes without dye. Any help would be appreciated. Okay, here's the problem, Eric. All of the natural colorings that I know that are red come from one of two like styles. There's betalains, which are from beets and other, you know, related plants, and anthocyanins, which you get in things like cabbages or in a bunch of flowers and teas. And all of those pigments are pH sensitive to one degree or another. Now that said, you can the cabbage is fairly neutral. If you want to go anthocyanin and beets, I don't know how neutral it is. The problem with beets is beets are extremely concentrated source of color, which is why they're good. But a good sort. I know you said you didn't want to do beets, but if you want to look at a really red cake that's beet based, go to the Big Bake Theory blogs, blog, and they the person there, I don't know who it is actually, but they did a whole series of tests. And the red velvet cake, their beet-based red velvet cake, is freaking red. And for them, you know, they point out all the things that are important. When you're using a natural dye, anthocyanin or betalain-based, like the things that are important are the pH, and you're going to want your pH to be lower, which means that you're going to have to switch away from the Dutch cocoa, unless you really, really insist on having the flavor of the Dutch processed cocoa, in which case you're going to have some difficulty, because it's difficult to get a bright red if you're going to have something. I mean, the reason that Dutch processed cocoa is the color it is and is the flavor it is because of the alkaline processing. And I think, like, in other words, I don't think you can just add extra acidity to neutralize the Dutch cocoa and have it work. But maybe you can. I have to run some tests. Heat. So they found on that website that, and I've noticed this as well, that the longer something is heated and the further away it is from raw, the less red it is and the more you have to use to get it to that color. So on that website, they literally blend in a food processor raw beets and water. It's got to be one king hell mess, right? It's got to be some messy stuff. I'm going to make Nastasha do that if she does it. Cause
hey, guys, we got a tweet in for with hashtag five things Hammer likes.
Oh, let's hear it.
Oh, well, yeah, wow.
I'm ready to disqualify number four, but I'll read it for you guys.
All right.
We've got champagne.
Oh, yes.
Check.
Yes.
Mark Ladner.
Oh!
I don't know why they said that.
All right.
I'm going to assume check.
Check.
California?
Hmm.
Check.
Mm.
That's kind of
broke. Yeah, I guess so. I have to give, yeah, okay.
But you hate everything from your childhood, and that includes California.
Not true. Go on, Jack.
All right, number four, this is where I disqualify hating hipsters. I don't know if you can like hating hipsters.
I know, that's kind of a strong move, though.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I do like hating on hipsters, though.
All right. And then number five is Zappos, a.k.a. Payless.
Yes.
So I'll let you give it the yay or nay, Nastasia.
Yay, yes.
All right, we got a winner.
Who is it?
T-shirts on the way.
Who is
cool.
it?
Cool. From Twitter, we got it's Elliot Papineau.
Oh, Elliot.
There we go.
And congratulations on your T-shirt. Doesn't he already have a T-shirt? Isn't he a member?
I don't know. Email us your size or maybe your girlfriend's size or something.
Nice.
We'll get one out.
All right, thanks for writing in, Elliot. Okay, so what I would do, Eric, and I'm going to try and look more into it. I have a bunch of articles that I have backlogged and to read on different ways to affect the stability of natural-based red and blue pigments, because I've been doing some anthocyanin work for the bar. So I'm going to try to get back to that. As soon as I figure it out, I'll do it. But go to the Big Bake Theories website and look up the recipe they have there. They don't use Dutch processed cocoa, and they use cream of tartar and buttermilk and fresh beets. So anyway, check it out. I know you said no beet, but check it out. You could probably do the same thing with cabbage as long as you really acidify the sucker so that it goes bright, bright red. Now, on the way out, I want to say that, you know, I'm on this, you know, Nation's Restaurant News. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Nation's Restaurant News?
Yeah.
I read it. Yeah. Anyway, it's Nation's Restaurant News. They send stuff to my inbox every day. So this one caught my eye. KFC, this is what's awesome about the world, right? This is big news. KFC is coming out with boneless chicken. Did you guys know this?
Yeah, they're doing away with the regular stuff, right?
Are they doing away with it?
I think the boneless will be the new promoted line above everything else.
Don't worry, folks. They're not like raising some sort of osteo-challenged chicken. They are actual chickens that the bones have been removed from. It's not like some like weird sack of growing chicken plasm that they have around. They're real chickens. Now, I've been saying, by the way, I've been saying boneless chicken for decades because my wife does not like to eat chicken off the bone. First of all, thank God she doesn't listen to a word I say because she hates when I talk about that in public. But she does not like to eat chicken on the bone. And so for years, I've boned everything, you know, bone the legs, bone everything. And it is really, frankly, more enjoyable. It's more enjoyable because I'm not going to call anyone out, Nastasha. But she takes three bites off the drumstick and then leaves all the meat around the bone.
Oh, no.
And thing away. Weak.
Very.
Yeah, whereas when you're boneless, you eat the whole thing. That's guilty as charged, right, Stas?
That is true.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, but it's endearing in a way. No. Anyway. So So here's the thing. It's like all of a sudden it's like huge news that they're going to go boneless on the KFC. And it's all they have to do to make big news is take the bones out of the freaking chicken.
That's all it takes.
We're in the wrong damn business. I swear to God. But this is what got me, and this is why I'm going to end with this. Here is a subset of everything that is wrong with the mental process of American food thinking. Okay, one of the firms that was hired by KFC as a senior consumer research manager said this about why they think the boneless Kentucky Fried Chicken is going to be popular. Are you ready for this? This is quoted in Nation's Restaurant News. I think this also has to do with healthfulness, because if you see boneless, even if the product is breaded and fried, we tend to think of boneless as less, and so therefore maybe more helpful. I think the healthful, seriously, I think the idea of boneless in general is one we'll see a lot more of. Can you freaking believe that, people? That is how dumb people think that we are, that by just having the word less attached to the word bone, that the fried chicken is going to be more healthful. Not that I like thinking of fried chicken in health terms anyway, because you know what you should eat? A reasonable amount of anything you find delicious, and don't go crazy, including fried chicken, bones in or bones out. Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.